Yes. Well, it was his idea. No, that's Fonzie.
Oh, yes, Fonzie. Yes. But Maloney also sounds. The name is
It could be, yes.
Yes, okay.
He was a very imaginative man, like Fonzie. And last November was the 40th anniversary of my first concert with the Naval Orchestra, 1937. So he said, why don't you tell the story of the Naval Orchestra on the radio? So I said, all right, I will, and I did, and I told the story for the first 10 years, and it was a very difficult year. There was no orchestra when I went there, and in 10 years we got so a reasonably good semi-professional orchestra, but you know what I mean. And we had some good players, and then we had some weak players, but in any case, it was enough to get us started. And about that time, Mr. Fonzie became mayor.
Yes.
And that was when this whole thing came about that we're going to talk about today. So then all of a sudden, about 2 months ago, Maloney called me up. He said, Rob, he said, I've got something I'd like you to do. And he said, I have the money to do it, if you'll do it. He said, I want you to give me a list of the composers that wrote music for our record series who are still alive and whom you could interview personally. Go and see them. Ask them how they felt about this. You don't need this in your life. Ask them how they felt about the commission when they got it, and ask them now how they feel about whether it was a helpful thing 25 or 30 years later. So that's really the purpose of this. And then, there are two things he said. He said, you see, the archives of the university, this project, he said, the first edition recording, in my opinion, is the most important cultural event that happened in Louisville and Kentucky during this current century. And I want in the archives of the university, you visit these composers and get them to tell their life story in their own words. And then we'll use that in the archives to keep for the record for people. And then for the second part, we'll play their music and you discuss that with them, and we'll broadcast that as a second part of the project, you see? So that's the background. And so I begin always with one question, and that is, was your family a musical family? Were your parents musical? Did you come of a musical?
Oh, no. Well, yes. My mother was a house pianist.
Yes.
But my father was a stockbroker,
yes,
which is very far from the music.
Yes, of course.
And she didn't like at all that I would become a musician.
May I ask, you were born in Barcelona?
Yes. So Barcelona, Spain. That's where I do go very often.
Yes. Which is Catalonia?
Oh, yes. It's the capital of Catalonia.
Okay. So, like the Charles and many other famous Spaniards,
like Montserrat Caballé, if you like to speak more contemporary, or Victoria de Los Angeles, or Alicia de la Roche, there are so many.
My heavens, you should be mentioning musicians, don't you?
Well, I don't know, but that happens here. And Albanians and Granados, all were Catalan.
Well, I didn't say. I didn't realize it, but so many of them were. Now, so that your mother was musical without being a musician.
Yes, what they call, I would dare to call her a good house cat.
Yes.
Therefore, I was acquainted with the house chopin from at the age of five.
Yes.
Played in a way I don't think you'll hear today, because that race of house pianos has disappeared from the world. One learns piano only to be a professional, or one doesn't learn at all the piano.
Yeah, none of those ones.
Also house piano.
Yes, definitely.
Well, you can be today a bed piano, but no longer a house piano.
Well, I follow you. That's very interesting. Well, when did you yourself begin to tinkle on the piano?
Oh, at the age of five. But I think I was no good, except that I picked all the music I was hearing in the street with a hurdy-gurdy, and I played back at the piano. I don't know, we had a couple of fingers.
Yeah.
By air.
Yeah. In other words, you are a natural born musician. When you heard music, you immediately wanted to reproduce it at the age of five.
To reproduce it at the age of five, six, seven, eight.
And at what time did your parents then decide to have you learn to be a pianist?
Oh, that was later, because always was a fight with my father who wanted me to go to make a solid education. Thought he would say a solid education meant to exclude music.
Of course, yes, this is a common practice. He was a practical man.
Yes, he didn't want me to
want to assure your financial future.
Right, right. Like would happen in any father of any youngster in I imagine, Wall Street.
Yes, yes. So then, so you would have to manage on your own for quite a while?
Well, I had a certain conspiracy with my mother.
Ah, that helped.
Yes, that helped us a lot. She always said to my father that was only a hobby. But
yes.
She was already thinking further, because she thought that I had some talent.
Well, obviously you did.
I don't know.
there's no doubt about it. So with your mother's help on the side, you began to learn to play more like a professional.
A little more, yeah. A little more, until late it was at the age of 12 that everybody decided that I should have a serious teacher.
I see. And you did then study seriously on the
floor. Yes, I began, but on the condition that I shouldn't give up the important studies, and that was what is a baccalaureate.
Which
is a high school, a sort of high school here in the United States.
I see. Mm-hmm. And were you interested in your scholastic work too?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did you enjoy your school?
Yes, yes, I enjoyed more music than anything else, but I enjoyed everything. I was a good student. Probably a good student in anything, but when I picked up the piano, that was my thing.
Yeah. And then, when did you first begin your composition in the more serious sense?
I began at that time already to compose. I have not seen that in the States. It may be out of fashion, but at that time in my youth, there were some instruments that they call guitarina, sort of guitar, but not an Indian guitar, a sort of lyra, where you put a paper below with lines and dots, and following the lines and stopping at the dots, you were playing the Merry Widow or or any popular song at that time in fashion.
Yeah.
And I began to imitate those papers with lines and dots. And I'm composing my own thing.
I see. What an original way to go about it.
Yes.
You actually made your own music paper.
Yes, my own music style of writing. But that was for the children, and I was writing for the other children, because that was...
Well, did you have brothers and sisters?
Brother.
At one time.
A brother.
Mm-hmm. I hope you became a respectable businessman.
No, never. Never. It was a failure of my father.
He was a musician too?
My father?
Your brother?
No, my brother was completely, no, the failure of my father was me.
Yeah.
My brother was the success of my father.
Yeah.
An older brother. That happens many times in the family.
Yeah. When did you, could you tell us a little more about your composing as it developed?
Well, my composing didn't develop well until, I think was the age of 17, when I had written with the advice of the vice director or the vice president, I don't know how you say, of the Municipal School of Barcelona. And he introduced me to a German conductor who came to conduct the opera house in Barcelona, German opera. And his name was Hugo Balcer. He was the general music director of the Düsseldorf Opera. And he wanted to see the things I had done, and he asked me permission to take them with him. I didn't have any care for the things I had written. And the first thing I learned 3 months later is that I had got a scholarship to go and study in Düsseldorf in Cologne.
Is that so?
I spoke a little German already because my mother was from Austrian extraction.
Oh, yeah.
So that helped.
Mm-hmm.
And there I was, after that, I was 5 solid years in Germany studying music and paid by the German. I think the name was Humboldt System, Foundation Humboldt.
Yeah.
Very famous. These were the people who were sponsoring me.
Maybe now I would go to
It was a great honor to be there.
Yes. And so your training is in Germany.
Yes. I have a German training with a Spanish blot and Spanish inclinations.
Yes.
It's a very strange melange.
Like for Ferraris.
I don't know what it is. But my music is very Spanish, and Vol Ferrari music is not German, not Italian. It's Italian, yes, but not Italian. It's more or less an international.
Yes, that's true.
Mm, yeah.
When did you first have your work published?
Well, that was in Paris. That was another story. I discovered during that time that my father was right, that I couldn't make a living with composing music. And the piano fell a little behind at that moment when I was having all that German training. And I had acquired good training in Germany to be a conductor. So I became a conductor. And I became I began as a backstage conductor in the Barcelona Opera House, and later I became a conductor in the Opera House, one of the conductors. So I began to conduct Bohème and Aida and Rigoletto and all those things. I was conducting those operas when I was very young, 25, 27, and 50. And at the same time I was composing. And as I was composing, I went to Paris. That was already after the war, in a thing that the French began to call les échanges culturels, the cultural exchange.
Yeah.
So there was a cultural exchange. Well, in the meantime, also I had become the conductor of the Philharmonic Orchestra in Barcelona. And With those cultural exchanges, the conductor of the La Murée Orchestra in Paris came to Barcelona, and I went to conduct the La Murée Orchestra in Paris.
I see.
And there I met the publisher Max Eschi, a very well internationally known publisher, and he was the one who took my first work. But there I found out that also at that time, immediately after the war, even conducting through Europe, and including Spain, you couldn't really make a living. And in a desperate way, I accepted a contract as the conductor of the Orchestra of Quito, Ecuador. I signed the contract, and I had to come to New York to go to Quito. And my publisher in Paris was very distressed that I was going to South America. And he said, don't forget to stop in Associated Music Publishers, who was his representative in the United States.
Here in New York, yes.
And he, in the meantime, he wrote the letter to Associated Music Publishers. And there I came to New York, and Associated Music Publishers said, don't go to Quito, South America, stay here. Well, I even don't have a visa to stay here. Well, we will introduce a bill in the Congress and make a visa happen for you. Very hard for the seller to get a visa here. It happened all that, and I never went to Quito,
but you
and the contract with Quito, fortunately, had a very good clause that was that the contract wouldn't be in force until I would be in Ecuador soil. But so I didn't mean to go to Quito, and I stayed here.
What year was it?
Oh, that was 1950.
So this would explain.
So that was about 4 years before the premiere of Sinfonietta Flamenca. I think was one of your first works in Louisville. I think the second work.
It was very early. It was in the first lot. Now that explains why it was in 48 that explained why it was difficult for Spaniards to get visas to the United States.
Or even now
to get into Franco.
No, I don't think it's Franco. There was a thing that they were calling quota. And Southern Europeans didn't have a good quota. For some reason, Northern Europeans had a good quota to come. But if a case came of distinction, there came a McCarran law. Who was bad for everybody, but was very good for me. Because that law provided that in a case of distinction, you might be given a special visa. And I was given
Now that 40, let me see, we began our series in 19... in January 1954.
Yes, and I think I was there in February or in March.
It was about 34 countries.
Yes, there was a Diocese law before, and I think it was And that was all, I think. I was a chair. And our you getting acquainted with me, I think it came through Marta Graham.
It must have, yes.
When I saw Marta Graham, I was still in a being considered to be a permanent resident in the United States by the immigration, when I saw a concert at the Carnegie Hall where Marcia Graham was dancing in the foreground of the stage, and you were conducting the Louis
Vuitton concert.
I was at that concert.
That was in 1950.
1950. It must have been a couple of months after I was here.
I remember that concert, and this must be 28 years ago. I remember that very well. A tremendous moment for me.
And it is very interesting that in this moment I am writing my fourth ballet for Marcia Graham, which is going to be premiered at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York this coming June 26th.
Congratulations, that's wonderful.
So she's still choreographed and she still is.
Isn't it amazing?
She's the greatest dame I have ever met.
Novice woman. And how is, well, I don't know how she is, but would you do me a great favor?
Yes.
Would you give her my affectionate?
I will, certainly.
Because you know, of course, the story about how it was the performance of Judith.
Yes.
In
Louisville. We spoke about you not long ago.
They kept the orchestra alive, and that took the Carnegie Hall once and for all. Ended the idea of disbanding the orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Never any more talk about that. Instead of that, we were sort of famous.
Yeah.
And so you were there.
Yeah, I was there. I was one of the audience.
Yes, indeed. It was a full house, as I
remember. It was a strange reaction, my reaction at that moment, when I didn't know neither you nor Marcia Graham personally. And the sort of dance I saw with Marcia impressed me greatly, but I found so different of what I had seen, particularly in France.
Yes,
that far, because it's a chasm of difference between, at least at that moment, there was a chasm of difference between the ballet, the regular ballet, and the so-called modern dance. Now it's getting very much close now.
I understand that her dancing is not like in Europe at first.
No, but I have seen some hints of that in Germany.
In the Yes Ballet, sir?
Through a company whose name was Rolf, the company of Rolf von Laban.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Yes, he seems to have been a precursor of all the modern dance.
Yes.
Together with Isidora Duncan and all that.
Well, please give her my affections and gratitude, because she made my career.
Well, she has been responsible for successful, three successful ballets of mine. There are four, but the fourth is being right, I'm writing it now.
Mm-hmm. I would love to see it. Mr. Clyde very kindly showed me the program. You're absolutely right. The first performance was on January 9th, 1954. You must have been almost the second one.
I think I was the second.
Was the first,
and I must tell you a great secret, that now, many years later, I don't feel as much respect to my own ego as I did when I was younger. The performance you did of Sinfonietta Flamenca at that time and the recording was much better than whatever has been done after in this work. And the work has been recorded four times. And one of the recordings was conducted by myself to the Paris Radio Symphony Orchestra.
What a wonderful
time. And when I saw that I couldn't reach a performance as good as yours, I was happy and very angry at the same time.
I remember you, well, I'll tell you, the piece excited me, sir.
Well, I think it must have excited you.
Otherwise, excited me, sir.
Also, you had devoted musicians. I don't know, you say they were not very good. I think by that time they must have been
they
very
were,
good.
By that time they developed into a band.
Because there is a stamina in the way you conduct it. Never more has been there.
Well,
so that record I cherish.
I still remember conducting it. It got me so excited. Later, I remember you visited us in our home and told me about, you played me some flamenco music and so on and so forth and explained about flamenco music. That certainly is a wonderful compliment. I thank you greatly for it. Because I was in a state of kind of near hysteria because it was also new and exciting, the whole idea of what we were doing.
I still remember that hall in Louisville, which was a dining hall or something. The floor of the hall was flat. It didn't have any. And it was incredible that so much new pieces and so much creation was taking place.
It was a very modest place.
In that modest place, it looked, there are some balls in Spain that they call cooperative balls, and mostly, at least in my time, I'm afraid now they have disappeared, but they were for service mates and soldiers.
Yeah. Well, I thought this was really
soldiers, yes. But there it took place a series of new work that many of them are great creations of the 20th century.
Well,
I don't know how much credit has been given to Louisville and to you particularly, but this really, really was a very exciting project that got to an end.
Yes.
May I say, and I am very outspoken, that many operas have been tempted through projects of American foundations financing them, and not one single success that I can remember.
Mm.
But these symphonic pieces, these were great creators.
We had a fine...
Not all of them, but many of them, and that,
well,
that was very exciting.
I remember time at the end of the first year when they appraised it, listed a number of them, including your piece, of course, as being outstanding works, Cowell Symphony and Dalla Piccola's Variations, and I can't remember the others, but they said that we had been very successful in artistically, but financially we were in the red.
You were?
Oh, yes.
Well, there was always the impression that you were full of Rockefeller money.
That's the interesting part of it.
As the French people would say, line it with gold.
Of course. There was the name Rockefeller behind you. How could you be poor? And of course, the whole conception, as you remember, was Mayor Farnsley.
I remember.
And it was his idea in the first place. And it was he, through his friends.
Is he still in?
I'm happy to say he's not only alive and well, but he has recently recovered from an illness and is a new man. He said he thinks he'll live another 20 years. He's in wonderful health.
Well, please give him my very dear regards.
I will indeed, because everything that we're talking about is a direct result of his planning and achieving. Someone this morning that we talked to said that
when you were giving the description of the place, he said it was like
a gymnasium,
which...
Well, you didn't have those gadgets that you have in the gymnasium, but it was about, yes.
There is a city, because
but
now...
But it has a stage. Yeah. A very untheatrical stage, but there was a stage.
Well, that was also it explains the Martha Graham dance, you see. See, when Charlie came to me, the mayor came to me when he became interested in the orchestra. And he said, I go to New York frequently, and I talk to composers there. And American music, symphonic music, is dying because it's never being played in New York. And someone should do something for American symphonic music, or it'll die because it never gets a hearing. Symphonic music.
Mm-hmm.
But that was before Metropolis came, and the conductors were usually foreigners. Now, Barbaroli would play English music, and the French composer, conductor would conduct French music, and Germans, you see.
But you see, you are going, you are putting the finger in the wound, as a Spanish saying goes.
Yes.
Metropolis and such other people were all conductors. And since they are dead, you can say a little evil words about them. They were conductors that were exclusive in style of the work they would perform or they would promote. You never were. You have been an extraordinarily eclectic conductor and man choosing your composer for
well,
your
let me explain to you about that. The mayor said to me, the LP record has just been invented, and it's going to change music just like the printing press changed the spoken word. And he said, the LP record is going to make it possible for symphonies to be played. And he said, also I know that Tchaikovsky can record music for LP record with an orchestra of 50 or 60 people. And he said, now I know that the American composer needs a champion. And he said, if you will do as I suggest, we'll become the champion here in Louisville of the American composer.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, other people will imitate us. And he said, we'll be famous and we'll be in the history book. Now then, the first thing he had to do was get us a hall. He said, the orchestra's too large. We can't afford an orchestra this size. How small a group could you use for this purpose? And I thought of members from the Gewandhaus Orchestra that I recall had been around in 1840, around 40 players. And then he borrowed from the opera house whenever he needed trombones and the instruments, you see. So I thought, well, 50 might be a possibility, so I said 50. He said, good. We'll decide on 50 then, and we can put that on two buses and take them to any high school auditorium in Kentucky, or we can put them on an airplane and take them anywhere. Now, he said, if you want to do this, you follow my advice and do this, he said, it'll make you famous. He said, you'll be in this history book. But he said, don't change your mind. You're the boss, he said to me. And if you decide to do this, you'll have to stick with it.
You are famous, and there is something in you as an intuition. Besides, masterfully ways of learning or seeing a score, there is an intuition of the style of the music of what should be, that from piece to piece you assimilate so well the composer that it looks completely as being conducted by the very, let me say, by the very animal who invented the work.
Oh, thank you. Well, I love to do it.
I'm sure you did have a good time.
I loved to do it, and there were a few pieces. People often ask me, well, you surely couldn't have liked to do them all. And there were a few that I found very hard to do, but not many. And I remembered the advice that Alan Copeland had given at Tanglewood some years before. He said, when a conductor plays a piece of music, he must play it as though it was the best piece of music that had ever been written.
Oh, that's right.
He said, you play that piece no matter how bad it is, as though you loved every note of it.
The performer who plays a piece of music, no matter what the piece is, at least for that time when he plays the piece, he must have faith in it.
He has to play it as though he had written it himself and loved every note of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remembered that, and I tried my best to do that.
Oh, you did a superb job.
Well, getting back to the hall, the orchestra was cut back to 50, but we couldn't get them on the stage. Stage was so small in that little hall.
Mm-hmm.
So the mayor had a half moon apron filled out in front in the hall, as you remember, of hardwood. The floor was hardwood, which was very resonant. You know, it was a very resonant hall. And so when a friend of ours, who was very interested in the orchestra and was very imaginative, Mrs. King, said, why don't you ask Martha Graham to come and dance on the apron and put the orchestra behind the scrim curtain and let her do a solo dance. So I thought that sounded like a good idea, and I wrote to Martha Graham and asked her if she would do this. She wrote back very enthusiastically. It seemed an interesting idea to her. She'd never thought of anything like it. It should be a solo dance, not a speech. And so when she came, she said, I said, well, please choose your own composer. So she selected William Schumann, and he wrote Judith.
Yes, I know.
And so when they came, she brought her whole New York people with her. She had Rosenthal to do the lighting, Gene Rosenthal. She had Calder for the costumes. She had Noguchi to do the sets.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Broadway production transferred to Louisville, and with this very powerful music by Judith, which excited me tremendously. And they loved it so that when we got through, they said, you must take this to New York and play it in Carnegie Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, and that's why we did it that way, you know, with the us back behind the curtain. And so that explains it to you.
Mm. Well, it has been a marvelous job. And not only you repeated your commission, in other words, also. It was very amazing.
Yeah, I love that.
Now, you know that has been played tremendously throughout the world.
That's a really effective piece.
Well, both. But since very amazing is an overture, and it is shorter.
Nice program.
This is a very, I don't know why all the conductors like short contemporary pieces.
Yes, thank you.
And it has been around, including Russia, Japan, Australia, and throughout Europe.
I had no idea.
Throughout Europe, throughout the States, including the radio orchestra of Madrid came to the United States and they played that work throughout the United States.
Oh, goodness, I didn't know that.
Well, I have never seen anything like that overture. Nothing popular.
Carlos, that night at my home, you had bought some genuine flamenco music, recording by Joe Pilar, was it such a person? I've forgotten the name.
I don't know, there are so many.
Yeah, well, anyhow, it was a revelation to me. And then you explained to me about the flamenco music and what it is. And now, because part of our dialogue is for the history book, writing for the past, for the future, but now we want to talk about the piece itself, and you've been very flattering about the way it was done, but what is flamenco music? And
well, there is, flamenco is the name to begin with, is an aberration, because flamenco in Spanish means from lowland, from Holland, flamon.
Yeah.
And has no relationship at all with what the music is, that it is a music emanating not only from the Gypsy, but also from the Moor and from the Sephardic Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Flamenco possibly comes because soldiers coming back to Spain from lowlands, when lowlands was a Spanish colony.
Yeah, the Netherlands.
The Netherlands. They were singing, they were this kind of people, many of them, and they were singing that sort of music. Nobody knows why that music is called flamenco.
Mm-hmm.
Now, flamenco means exactly a music that emanates exactly of the three races that were expelled from Spain
by
Ferdinand and Isabella in the same year that America was discovered.
Yes, 1492.
Yes. Or, I think it was the same year.
Yes, it was, I think.
Yes, I think it was the same year. I mean, I'm not a historian, but I think it was.
I'm an amateur.
Yes. By some reason, these three races, or these three people, have some similarity in their singing. There is an erudite, you say in English, erudite, who is a priest, is dead now, but very famous in Spain. His name is Mosén Isidro Anglés. He has a tremendous book whose name is Acerca del Influjo, Influjo Árabe. Árabe. It's not Arab, again, it's Sephardic, Gypsy, and Moor. And he says that this begins in Casablanca and ends in India, going throughout North Africa, Middle East, and Iran and Persia, and arriving to India. In other words, it includes the Muslim people. It includes the Sephardic Jews, and it includes the Gypsies. The three have been nomad races.
Yes.
And maybe the fact that they have circulated that much unifies the music in that tremendously large area.
Yes.
They use a very particular scale that I will say in my possibilities, C-sharp, D-sharp, E, F-sharp, G, A, B-flat, and again C. This is a scale instead of seven notes of eight notes. And of course it can be done in other keys.
Okay.
The resolution never are from the living tone to the tonica, but from the second minor tone, leading to the tonic. In other words, the way of resting and the way of making a cadenza is always going down, never going up. Then there are several things that I cannot explain because they are intricate. You must have heard that music and you must have digested that music in your blood by feeling it, by being part of a country that uses that music. The case is that even when these three races were expelled from Spain, this music remained in Spain. And it remained throughout the Berber in Morocco. It remained in Israel. You would find many melodies of Sephardic Israeli that are very similar to the flamenco music. And then there is, let's say, adulterated flamenco, which is the flamenco of the nightclub. It has many, many authentic devices. And my music, a blend of all that, the way I see if it is authentic, it's because I am Spanish. But it doesn't mean to imitate the authentic thing. It means to emanate from me thinking that this, but if anybody from those countries hears my music, immediately they get awake as being there. So. And that includes Spain. That includes any part of Spain.
Has the Sinfonietta been popular in Spain?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes, yes. Nice.
It's given by the radio all the time.
It made a tremendous hit in Louisville.
Yes, I remember.
If
I may be modest, I remember.
They were so excited.
Yes, yes.
And you know, people were dreading this series. So many people were dreading this series. And Mr. Toth wrote a beautiful, gentle nocturne. Really a lovely piece of music, but very gentle, almost piece of chamber music, which people found very pleasant. And then all of a sudden, just like an explosion, came this very violent and exciting music.
I remember, and my publishers were very amused, when one paper of Louisville said that your hat got with the Sinfonietta Flamenca, the exact part.
Yes.
Or the commission. And I didn't know what the jackpot meant in English. My publisher said, well, this is something you will learn when you go to Las Vegas.
Very fascinating. Well, when we play this piece now in the stage, we'll be able to reproduce some of this book. And as I said, talking about the music, to play it and record it, and I thought we would probably be able to do both of the two pieces of it.
Thank you very much. You also recorded it very well. It was necessary, and we hear that you used the symphonic variation very beautifully.
We have to start doing that later.
If you like to find more details, and I hate to say that, being on the air, because it looks like I'm making myself self-publicity. There is a new recording of a work I wrote for Alicia de la Rosa, released in London, that was, is my piano concerto. It's a much more recent, and that's the music of San Francisco. scientifically explain.
Now then, one of the questions that I'm supposed to ask you, guest, is when you received the commission from the Louisville Orchestra, what was your first reaction?
I went to the bank to cash the check.
No, that's later. I meant the letter inviting you to write the check.
Oh, well, I said yes. Well, but the check came immediately, and as I talked to you about the jackpot, there was another new word in English, who was the reaction of the bank teller, you said?
Yes.
The bank teller. It was a key, to say, of that perspective. I don't know what she meant.
No, I don't either.
But it was $1,200, and at that time, $1,200 was a lot of money.
Yes, sir.
Well, now it's nothing.
No, I know. Too bad.
But now, at that moment, it was a lot of money. And she said, that's a good step.
I don't know what that means.
I don't know what she meant.
But he cast it, that's the
point. Oh, yes, of course.
And then the other question I'm to ask you is 22, 23, what is 1950? How many years is it?
24 years since the 1954 performance.
It's 24 years later. Would you say, in retrospect, that this project was a worthwhile thing for the cause of American music in particular?
Well, I already have said to you how much
I know you have.
How I feel about that. And the only regret I have is that the initiative of foundation don't seem to go so directly to composers as they did when your project was alive. They seem to sponsor groups, performers, all things, and somehow the creative work has been undermined or diminished, to say the least.
Yes, of course.
So allow me to say that I would celebrate, and this is not because me, because I'm not a baby anymore. I have some age. It's not because the profit I am going to have, but I think what makes a country and what makes a culture is not performing, it's creating.
Of course,
composers need performers.
Right.
But the performers wouldn't have anything to play if had it not been created before.
Well, I think the proof of that is that if you look in an encyclopedia and take the name of creative musicians or artists of any type, these are important.
Yes.
But the performer,
they get three lines or five lines.
And it's necessary, Paganini or a list or
yes,
one.
They
one
have a few lines, and if you take any composer or by the same token, any painter, any creative artist, that's all the same. Because
he has immortality.
Yeah, well, I don't know if that's the case, but it is.
Yes.
It is the case.
No.
You remember Toscanini? Toscanini?
Yeah, but
50 years from now will be only a legend. Even the recordings will not circulate. But the print is music. Always circulate.
That's right. No, there's no
at
doubt.
At least the music that has been not forgotten.
That's right.
There are forgotten works.
And because the nice thing about our project was it was to give everyone possible a chance, whether they were famous or not. And some were famous already.
Well, I don't think many people would have been established later in the United States, and allow me that may include me, or it may have taken a lot of more time had not the Louisville project taken place.
Yes, I really believe you're right about that.
That was a great thing, and also, may I say, it was a great example to the world. It was a moment. Now the world believes in America, in the arts.
Yes, of course.
Particularly performance.
Yes.
America has a great name in the world, but not 28 years ago.
When I went to Paris, I was to go to see Jacques Huber, who was the chief commission, and I went up to the French radio station, because in Europe, you know, the radio stations were the center of contemporary music in every country, and I met Jacques Barrault, I believe it was.
Henri Barrault.
And I introduced...
He was the director of the French National
Radio
and Television.
And
he died.
That's why I went to see him. And I said, my name is Whitney, and I come from Louisville, Kentucky. And I'm looking for some names for you to recommend to me of French composers who we could commission for Louisville. And I said, he was simply astounded. And he said, the Rockefeller Foundation had given us this money. Of course, everybody had heard of Rockefeller. That was no surprise. But he said, where is Louisville? And I said, well, Mr. Barrault, I don't know how to explain to you in any better way than, do you know where Chicago is in the United States? And he said, yes. And I said, do you know where New Orleans is? And he said, yes. Well, I said, it's roughly halfway. We draw a line between those.
Yes.
So that was the idea.
Well, a little more near Chicago than New Orleans.
And a few years later, when Hubert had done his Louisville concert, why, of course, he knew where it was.
Where Louisville was.
And I never commissioned him, so
yes,
well,
there is something of that to have put Louisville in the map. Because, no, all Europeans, including today, they have a very rudimentary idea of the United States map.
Yes.
They all know New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, because the movie.
Yes.
They all know Beverly Hills.
Yes.
They all know Hollywood.
Yes.
San Francisco, a little less. But New Orleans, a little. But you may, with people that don't have, let's say, a real education, you may stop with 5 or 10 cities.
That's all understandable. Well, Carlos, I can't tell you what a joy it is to see you and see you looking so well.
Well, you do look well, too.
Well, and I think it's because we're both being able to be active and creative.
Yes,
and,
I think it's a satisfaction when you have some age. And I have a drawer in my home with one copy only of all the work I have published. And I said, well, there is that.
Yes.
And that's a satisfaction to have done. I don't know how important it is or will be.
But there it is.
Who knows? I have done all I could.
Yes. And it's you.
And it's me.
It may
increase, it may diminish, you don't know.
Well, I'm very fortunate too, and for the fact that I go to hear the orchestra now, which has been very much improved.
Well, the orchestra of Louisville wouldn't have a standard as it has today. It wouldn't be because you.
Well, in any case, when I go to hear it now, I really get a great thrill out of it because it plays superbly, and it's very exciting to walk out of the hall and think, oh, I had a big part in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm fortunate in that respect. And I think those things keep one young. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
And best of luck with your
future
work.
Well, the same to you. The same to you. Well, all that was recorded? My God, you have stopped here for 2 years. Well, we got something you may cut. But something was a little bit blurry or not. I agree on everything I have said, but it may not be well said. Okay, so what kind of music are you if I am, may I? With Marcel and there are